Welcome to the wide, wide world of literary conversations. Bat Segundo couldn't make it this week, and while my own expertise lies in obnoxious sports casting, that didn't stop the producers from calling me up to fill in. Amy Bloom was born in 1953. In the rough and seamy streets of rural Connecticut, she had a hard, hard upper-class life. She was, for a time, a psychotherapist, and it was this expertise that led quite naturally to writing a lifetime television show, State of Mind. But she also wrote stories and books, and it was this that led our young roving correspondent to talk with her. Why was this interview, recorded months ago, delayed so long? Could it be the fact that Miss Bloom answered her phone in the middle of an interview? And why am I being such an overbearing asshole? You, dear listeners, make the call.
We're here with Amy Bloom, most recently the author of Away. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
One of the things that primarily attracted me to reading Away was the treatment of the Yiddish theater and the world that Lillian sort of finds herself in. I just wondered, why did you decide to open the book with Lillian enmeshed, I guess on Second Avenue and within the Yiddish theater world?
You mean as opposed to starting it at the very beginning of her story, or why the Yiddish theater?
I guess both, but let's start with why the Yiddish theater.
Well, my great aunt and uncle were patrons of the Yiddish opera, which in its vaudeville aspects, I think, makes the Yiddish theater look like Ibsen.
In what way?
Well, there was just a very lively sense that everything was fair game. One could borrow freely from all media. It was actually the thing that I loved about the Yiddish theater, too. And it's also the case that besides it being a very comfortable place for me to start, because there is a great pleasure, I think, when you're launching yourself on a sort of big trip, to at least start with familiar luggage. And the Yiddish theater was certainly that for me. Plus, I grew up doing theater as a kid, and I have a tremendous soft spot for small theaters of all kinds.
Now, did you just do English theater, or did you also do any kind of Yiddish theater, too?
No, I actually had a pretty good command of Yiddish when I was a kid, but Yiddish theater was already gone by the time I was a child. So, no, I did things like, you know, the enactment of The Fog Comes In on Little Cat Feet. I was the lead cat.
Oh, I see.
For example.
And then I guess the other sort of half of the question, which is, you know, why begin there as opposed to at any other point?
Partially because I think it's always more exciting to begin in the middle than to begin at the beginning. And also for a long time I actually had opened the novel with the massacre. And then felt that it was almost too hard to go anywhere after that.
That it was just too much of a major event?
Well, right. That somehow you just sort of went, oh, you know, and you exhaled. And it was hard to sort of pick oneself up and go anywhere else. I thought it would be better to know Lillian a little bit before everything was colored with tragedy than to color it with tragedy and then get to know her.
I guess just to go back a little bit again is that you had mentioned that this is a familiar world to you, but to most general readership, the Yiddish theater is going to be very unfamiliar. So was there any sense of any kind of juxtaposition, or just because you were so familiar that you just sort of plunged right in and then
I tend in some way, I do of course write to be read, but I also write for myself, and I wouldn't have, I wasn't interested in putting her in some place that was very familiar to everybody, you know. On the other hand, I think that the immigrant story and coming to the Lower East Side and working as a seamstress is not an unfamiliar story in the sort of the bigger brushstrokes.
And I think also because you're starting off in a very enclosed space. I know early in the book you talk about the 57 blocks of the Lower East Side and 500,000 Jews, and you go sort of through this numerical value. And then at the end it's that Lillian sees opportunity. Mm-hmm. And then it's almost as if as the book progresses, you go further out. So was it sort of this triangular effect always on your mind?
It wasn't on my mind, but it did become apparent to me in retrospect. I think most of the time when you're writing a book, you only understand what you've done afterwards, and usually actually a couple of years afterwards. But I did understand that we went through a series of hallways and the rooms got bigger and bigger. And I did understand afterwards that her English changed. I mean, I was very conscious of that. But I did then see that both the narrative and Lillian's speech itself and Lillian's thoughts as they were expressed become more and more expressive of American English.
In that, like, it starts out being very, I guess, Eastern European Russian inflected and
right.
then gradually becomes more and more American.
I think so. I mean, I think she is exposed to more and more Americans and more Americans who are have been in this country for a while, unlike her own self and her own family. These are people who are first generation or second generation Americans. Gumdrop, Chinky Chang, they both speak completely uninflected standard American English, unlike Lillian. And these are the people with whom she spends her time, and John Bishop and Arthur Gilpin.
So, and it's sort of these parallels too between an enclosed Jewish community and the greater sort of non-Jewish world. And one thing I did find in a way is how there are all these sort of, first there's the Jewish and Jewish interactions, and then there's sort of Lillian with John and Gumdrop and her fate sort of inverted. And I just wondered, was there any subversion going on, or it's just reflecting the times?
Well, I mean, as a writer, you always choose. You go this and not this, you know, the yellow rose and not the pink peony. I mean, you choose that all the time. For me, these were the people who were interesting as they sort of showed up in my imagination. And also, immigrants of all kinds interest me. Travelers of all kinds interest me. Different fish out of different waters always interest me. And that's who these characters were. And I do think it is true that the good and the bad news when you knock down the ghetto wall is that people can leave and some things get lost.
So now to sort of bring it back, I want to just talk a little bit about Lillian's relationship with the Bursteins. The first thing that struck me, especially I went back and I tend to read acknowledgments in the notes, is that Burstein is a very famous name in the Yiddish world with Lillian Lux and Pesachki Burstein. So I just wonder, was that conscious or just...
You know, this is sort of shocking to me, but it actually was not conscious. I read that. I've actually met Mike Burstein, their son, who is lovely, who came to a reading in L.A. and just wept. And that was wonderful. I'm glad now because the Bursteins see it as a tribute, and I'm delighted. But truthfully, that book just sort of folded itself in because the details of my Bursteins, Reuben and Meyer, who are not Pesacha and Lillian, are very different. But very, very different. I mean, they were a famously married couple. They were the head of a small dynasty. It was a very different world. But I guess the name just stayed with me. It sort of slipped under the covers, as these things do.
It almost seems like an iconic name to use and then
yes.
to...
That is
subvert.
How it felt. I mean, I didn't call them the Tomaszewskis. You know.
That might have been a little obvious. But at least the family saw it as a tribute.
Absolutely. They were delighted. They were delighted that the name was being used. They were delighted with the acknowledgement. I'm a certain. And I think they felt that their significance in the Yiddish theater was being perceived, and they were happy about that.
And to sort of expand on this whole triangle, I mean, it's pretty obvious there's some serious power struggles going on, you know, in terms of how Lillian and Meyer interact, how Lillian and Reuben interact, and I've almost it's almost as if power is almost a theme running through the whole book, and I just wanted to sort of, you know, elaborate a little bit about that.
Well, I think that it is in many ways. Plus we'll bury it. I don't think that you can have relationships, least of all intimate relationships, in which there's a significant power differential without that rearing its head. And I think people who think that you can are kidding themselves.
But what specifically were you trying to go after? And in terms of
how it changes. I think everybody uses what they have. You know, it is not unheard of in this world before or after the 1920s that a young woman with not much education and no particular professional skills has essentially her face, her body, and her mind as a way of equalizing the power differential in her relationships with other people. Ruben, I think, understands very much what he has to offer as a powerful man, and Meyer understands what he has to offer. I mean, everybody is very clear, in some sense, on what the deal is. And Lillian feels that she is clear too, and it is only at the end, of course, that she understands that she misjudged how much power she had, and also because of her own stubbornness, she didn't ask for help where she could have gotten it, which is one of those things that strikes me that you always realize after the fact in life.
That's very true. And to sort of go back to bringing up the face, body, and mind, it's in this world, it doesn't matter what Lillian's past is. It almost doesn't matter what else she might have to offer. It's just the surface traits that are...
Well, and also, in reality, what else does she have to offer? Her English isn't very good. She has no particular professional skills. She's not a terrific seamstress. She's an adequate seamstress with lousy language, and she just got here 3 months ago. And there may be people out there in the world who think that the lives of young women coming to this country now are very, very different. But I don't think so.
Just elaborate on that for...
I think it's a hard thing to do. I think to leave your country and come to this place where people automatically think that you are stupid because you don't speak their language very well, to not be perceived as who you are, to have only a few very basic things to offer, and that you are endlessly at other people's mercy. This does not seem to me sort of like a fanciful hardship that makes a good story. This seems to me the way it is for most people who come to this country, even now.
That's a very good point. Just to talk a little bit, too, since you already mentioned Gumdrop and Chinky, and of course Gumdrop is black and Chinky is Chinese, and as you said, I guess first generation American. Why did you decide, I guess, to bring in those two women and create them as they were? And you know, what did you feel like you were trying to portray, especially in relation to Lillian?
Well, it's a big world, and a world in which all the characters look alike is not that interesting to me. I see. Gumdrop she just appeared to me the way she was, and a strong and interesting and complicated person. And they are both women who befriend Lillian for good reason. Gumdrop because she thinks Lillian will be of use, Chinky because Lillian saves her life. And one needs an ally in a place like a work center, like a work farm. And they also struck me as both being people who gave us other interesting stories of being new Americans.
I guess I'm thinking of it too in the sense of going back to the ghetto aspect of it, in that would someone like Lillian have been as likely to run into people like Gumdrop and Chinky and sort of look for someone similar to her own self, if such a person actually existed, or because it was this removal that...
Yes, if we had stayed in the Lower East Side, it would have been a different story. It would have been, call it sleep. It would have been something else. It would have been Herman Wouk's City Boy, which is actually a wonderful book. But it wouldn't have been this book. This book is much more, as my younger daughter said when she finished it, "Oh, Mommy, it's like Ulysses with women and Jews." And I thought, I'm all right with that. It is, the journey is important. She is not staying put. She is not just seeing people who are in some way like her, although I would argue that she meets as many people who are like her as people who are not, and one should never be fooled by the package.
One should never just judge by surface deep, in other words.
Well, it's, you know, it's like those great efforts that people go to not to marry their mother, only to discover that mothers come in all genders and all packages.
Which sort of segues into one really telling part of the book, which is a scene where you have, I think, Meyer sort of go into the future. And and it's a really interesting description of what he's like 20 or 30 years down the line, and he realizes that he's on his way to becoming his father.
Absolutely.
So I guess, you know, what sort of elements of repetition do you have, even when you're trying so hard to be outside of your upbringing, your background, and search of this other, that you just keep getting drawn back in? So that the reason I asked about Lillian running into people who are different than themselves is, I don't know, I guess, would it be as likely that she almost unconsciously would be seeking out people like her, even if it's just soul recognition?
Well, people like you, or people who can help you, or people who have a quality that you like. I mean, for example, there's a description. I mean, I know I say it as if somebody else wrote it. There's a description, but I wrote a description of both Gumdrop and Chinky reminding Lillian at various moments of Esther Burstein, both of them. It's something in the smile, which is both knowing and a little dark, but not entirely unkind. And I think all three of those women have that quality, and all three of those women are women who make the most of what they have and have a very clear view of what is available to them. Although I think Gumdrop makes the greatest leap, sort of across the Grand Canyon socially, and Chinky, of course, marries for love.
For my next question, to sort of frame it in the within these three women, one thing you do, especially considering that Away is not this expansive epic book, is that you're compressing sort of what happens to Chinky, to Gumdrop, and to a certain extent to Lillian too at the end, into these very tightly packed, almost, you know, several paragraphs. And why did you feel that you had to sort of compress as opposed to expand outward?
I didn't feel that I had to compress. I actually, first of all, I had no wish to write a 600-page book. Just period. I had no wish to write a 600-page book. I've almost never read a 600-page book that wouldn't have been better off as a 400-page book. So there was that. Although it might be that my goal will be to write a 400-page book. But the other thing, I think, is that what I felt was that there was a river of narrative, which was Lillian's story in the present, you know, in the present of Lillian's life. And that these other moments into the future were like little tributaries, and they flowed into the future, and then they flowed back to Lillian. And that is actually what I wanted. So it doesn't feel to me like compression. It feels to me like looking out the window and catching a glimpse of your neighbor passionately kissing whoever. It's not that it is compressed. It just might be that in that moment you have seen all you really need to see.
That there's really no need to sort of go beyond
a snapshot. I didn't feel that there was anything missing. I didn't feel that I needed to show you the street, the Gumdrop and Mr. Tabloom lived on, that I didn't need to show you the Hadassah luncheon. You know, that the reader, I think if the characters are drawn clearly enough, the reader can see into the future with you.
Well, that's a good point. I guess it's just in terms of measuring out emotional impact, or whether it's more important to show that in a very sort of measured way, or to have the reader sort of really deep into the character's head and really feel those emotions along with them, as opposed to just getting a sideways glimpse, really, and then coming right back.
Well, it is Lillian's story. And it is not the story of, like, women across America. It is, or men across America. It is Lillian's story. And, you know, for different characters, it went differently. I mean, for me, I feel that the entire story of Chinky and Cleveland is in great emotional detail. You see everything about who they are, you know, from beginning to end. With somebody else, it might only be a snapshot. But I think part of it also has to do with the way in which I think life is. That you don't actually get to see the whole story of everybody you meet. or care about. People change, they move away, things fall by the wayside. Sometimes you get to know, sometimes you don't get to know. And that was actually part of the quality. There's a wonderful moment in the omniscient narration of Wings of the Dove by Henry James, in which he takes us up the stairs of the piazza and outside a bedroom door, and then the omniscient narrator says to us, there are some conversations one doesn't get to overhear. And that was part of what I wanted. I wanted to say, we don't get to know everything. We don't get to see everything.
Yeah, I'm just trying to, I guess, process that thought a little bit, in the sense that we don't get to see everything, but at the same time, it is Lilia's story and primarily told from her point of view. So even to show what happens to these other characters as separate from her, is that necessarily a fair thing to do? Or,
well, it's fiction, so everything is fair. So I guess it's a question of what fair means. I mean, it's an omniscient narrator. The narrator spends a lot of time with Lillian because it's Lillian's story, but the omniscient narrator knows everything. The omniscient narrator can compare the tailor Yaakov Schimmelman to Coco Chanel. That's not Lillian's point of view. So it's always the omniscient narrator. It's God's eye. And God can follow Lillian with one hand and Chinky with the other, and then basically draws it back to Lillian. I mean, that's how I see it.
Sort of a convergence and divergence of curtains.
I see it literally as like a wave of the hand.
Which I guess sort of brings me into my next sort of train of thought, which is that imagery figures heavily into this book. And one scene that really struck me was when, I think, Lillian's first love scene, I suppose, with Reuben. And if anything, what was the greater preoccupation was with towels and napkins as opposed to the actual act. So what does this specific type of imagery allow you to do?
Well, I don't think that, as Lillian says later, you know, it wasn't great sex. It was okay. It was a little more tenderness than she had expected. It wasn't much. It was not a huge physical experience for her. And because she was preoccupied with, you know, also secrecy and carefulness, those were her primary concerns. I think one of the things about Lillian is that she is not sentimental.
That's very true.
And which does not mean that she is not emotional, but it does mean that there's not a lot of frothy, tearful, oh, look at me, hand-wringing. She sees how things are, and she does what she must, as she says all the time, as one must, one can. And that is not something one says cheerfully, necessarily.
Yeah, there's usually some kind of bitter ruefulness attached to it.
Right, as it is. But I think that she, later on, there's a moment where she's lying actually with her head on Reuben's shoulder, and she's looking at his body. And I think that is the tenderness. The tenderness is when she hears him say her name in Yiddish. The tenderness is later when he's brushing her hair. The act itself, especially the first time, there's not much tenderness. I think the real romance of sex for her comes much later, and as a surprise.
And in a place she would never have expected to.
That too.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Alaska. And I know that you had spent some time there researching the book, and I believe also, did you teach up there? Or?
Oh, I just went to give a couple of talks, and I really just gave the talks because I wanted to get to Alaska, and I want somebody else to pay my plane fare.
Where did you speak?
I was in Fairbanks and Anchorage and Homer.
And what was your initial response upon seeing Alaska? Was it what you expected? Were there surprises?
I had no expectations at all. Alaska is not a place that had figured much in my mental landscape. I mean, I have a lot of thoughts about Tuscany and about Cape Cod. I have really almost no thoughts at all about Alaska. So very big and exceptional, you know, exceptional sort of vistas and landscapes and long views and animals. And it was great. And one of the great pleasures for me, of course, is that since Lillian is essentially an urban creature, I don't have to make her into Natty Bumppo. She can be as surprised and startled and as unsure as I would be, which was a great relief.
In that you didn't have to project anything else.
Right, I didn't have to have her, you know, nimbly handling this and this and eyeing berries and going, oh, clearly those can be used to do da 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 da. It's like she wouldn't know any more than I would know.
So I guess what was, well, I know what was the sense of getting to Alaska and that it was as close as you can be within the United States and still be close to Russia.
Mm-hmm.
But to have her then go up into the Yukon, into Canada, what sort of, I guess, juxtapositions or contrasts did you find between the U.S. side and the Canadian side?
Well, I mean, in terms of the book, it really had more to do with her winding up on the work farm and entering yet another community, sort of this Canadian community of sort of marginally criminal women, you know, by and large, not people who were violent, you know. This is why it's a work farm and not, you know, a penal colony. And also, you know, Dawson was for many people sort of the place in which you got onto the Yukon River, you know, and made your way. I thought that for me, the distinction between Canada and the United States was not, I am sorry to say, because I'm sure my Canadian readers won't appreciate this, was not of great significance. Once I entered the northern provinces, it was all, for Lillian, the north.
There was no distinction and no border.
No, it was just this big, wide, cold, interesting place where everything was sort of wide open, except for the little cabins.
It's also interesting to contrast Lillian's take on Alaska as, you know, one Jewish woman in this great expanse with what Michael Chabon did with the Yiddish Policemen's Union.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that had to be a total coincidence. But it's just, I guess, interesting to me to compare his take of creating this Yiddish homeland out of wholesale cloth with your more singular approach to, you know, one person's take on Alaska. I guess,
right.
What
Lillian is not a collegial soul, and you know, the Yiddish homeland in some sense gets addressed because actually there was one, you know, which, you know, Stalin had in mind, perhaps not with the kindest of intentions, in Siberia. I mean, that was and is a real place, but for Lillian, this was about a journey and a quest, not about building a community.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about this quest idea. Was that something that you needed right away to sort of keep the plot going?
Well, you can't just have people wandering around. I mean, you can, but I'm not Camus, you know. I'm not going to just have people just kind of wandering around.
It wasn't going to be Lillian's existential journey through her own mind.
It was not, because I couldn't bear it. My interest in existential journeys is extremely limited. I think it has to do with this idea that there are really only two plots, right? I go on a journey, or a stranger comes to town. And it always seemed to me that really that's the same plot. It just depends on whether you're standing in the town square or you're on horseback. And it did seem to me that it would be interesting for a change to have a woman on horseback.
Yeah, because generally it seems like women's novels featuring women of late either get shoehorned into various genre ghettos, I suppose, or they're much more sort of either existential or just, you know, more cerebral. So to have a woman go on a quest, you're right, is very, or at least it's somewhat unusual if you're not working within genre confines.
Right. She does. You know, she does not just think or muse or worry or whine. She does, and she doesn't always do it well, which was also important to me. She's not a superhero. She just does the best she can.
The superheroes aren't interesting to you?
Not so much. I mean, I like them. I mean, who wouldn't like to fly? The fabulous stretchy fabric and the capes. I mean, I think that's great, but no, not so much.
Not in this circumstance, in any case. The reason also that I brought up plotting is that I'd read an interview with you from some years back where you said you had a mystery novel in the drawer.
Yeah, that's still true. I mean, unless I've managed to burn down the desk that the drawer is in. Yeah, that will never see the light of day. But it was good to learn how to write, which is really what I did with it. And Yeah, I mean, I love mysteries. I like to read them, and one doesn't mind the formulaic quality at all. It's one of the pleasures of the book. For this book, I just wanted to... There's a great line from a Paula Fox memoir where she's talking about her adolescence, I think, or her young adulthood, and she says, I didn't have the nerve to do what came next, so I had to do it without the nerve. And that's how I think of Lillian. It's not that she's particularly brave or nervy or fearless. It's just that it must be done. And so she does. And I love the fact that she does it badly and awkwardly and makes mistakes and makes wrong turns and makes wrong choices because she's a person. But nevertheless, she is also a person involved in this big story. And for me, you know, having listened to a lot of immigrant stories and read a lot of immigrant stories, not to mention stories of people in Alaska and in the Yukon and, you know, women who trekked 1,000 miles to get medical care for their children, things like that. What is it you'd like? For us to close our mouth? I don't think so. Would you like us to close out? Is that what you'd like us to do?
You're not going to get anything else and you're staying here? It would be good unless you're going to get something.
We're going to close out pretty soon.
Okay.
Why don't we just do that? Why don't we just give them money and we'll be done?
And you can stay as long as you want.
Gotcha.
The other reason I brought up the mystery novel element was just whether that early effort at plotting...
Well, I would say, I think we'd have to say it did not bear fruit because, as you will observe from the first three books I wrote, plotting was not a big part of it. I mean, there's plotting in Love Invents Us, there's plotting in that novel in the sense that things do happen. But not too much happens. Some things happen.
Thank you, guys.
Sure. And in this book, I think I really wanted... to write what I thought of as a 21st century, 19th century novel. It had nothing to do with wanting to write historical fiction. It had to do with a particular art of storytelling and a particular commitment to storytelling that I love in 19th century fiction. And that's what I wanted to do. I didn't want to reproduce it in terms of timelines or chronology or style, but I wanted a real story. I wanted really interesting characters, and I wanted a journey. I wanted, you know, Great Expectations or David Copperfield. I mean, I wanted a big story that was nevertheless, in the sort of the modern sense, expressive of a person and a life and an inner life in a way that one didn't always get with the 19th century novel, you know. I wanted to be able to explore people's psyches and their social lives and their sexual lives and their cultural lives in ways that were maybe not always as common in 19th century fiction without losing sight of the story. I wanted both. I wanted, as Gardner said, the great flaw in 19th century fiction, you know, is sentimentality. The great flaw in modern fiction is that it has no heart. I wanted to see if I could address both of those problems.
I'll just ask a couple more questions and then we'll wrap things up. But you've gone from writing short stories, novels, nonfiction, and also television work. And I just wonder, is there any format that you've not tried that you want to try next?
Well, there are some that I have not tried for good reason. You won't be seeing the collected poetry of Amy Bloom anytime soon, nor my, you know, haiku, nor my opera. I'd like to do a play, but that may end up getting expressed through screenplays. And I'll do another novel, and I'll do another collection of short stories.
What does each form, I guess, allow you to do? Like, how do you think about them each a little bit differently?
I think the burst of intensity of the short story is one kind of pleasure, and the sustained intensity of the novel is another. And the freedom to write well but without the demands of the narrative is nice in a screenplay. It is all show, no tell, and you don't have much choice about it. So those are all different kinds of pleasures. but writing fiction is always my first choice.
And presumably that's why you decided to leave your psychotherapy practice behind and write full time.
Yeah, at least for now. I suspect there'll be a few people I'll go on seeing, and I may go back to having a larger practice at some point, but for me, to have a year to write, this is the first time in my life. So
you're completely free of all other commitments at this point?
I am, just for 1 year.
Well, on that note, best of luck with the year. Thanks so much for talking with me today, and apologies for all the interruptions and the like.
There's also some exciting stuff going on out there.
No kidding.
Cute.